This is Wayne Zell, and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, your fast-paced video cast designed to help you realize your dreams of wealth and freedom and everything else that you can imagine. And all our guests are entrepreneurs, people who have built businesses, who have designed businesses, who are building businesses. And today I have a new entrepreneur with me, Kavita Sahai. Welcome, Kavita, to the show. I can't wait to talk to you about a variety of topics.
Oh, thank you so much, Wayne. I'm so happy to be here.
Thanks. And, you know, first we're going to talk a little bit about your background. I have your resume, and of course, that's great. You started off. Are you from Florida originally?
I was actually born in Los Angeles. So okay. I've kind of gone back and forth.
How did you get from Los Angeles to Florida, which is where you went for your BS?
Yeah, I was born in Los Angeles, but then my father was an engineer in the oil industry. And so we then went to the Middle East. We lived there for several years and then came back to California, where I finished off middle school. And then my father got posted back in the Middle East. But at that time, they didn't allow even for foreigners to have high school for girls. So my mom sort of had this hard decision of go with my dad and send me to boarding school or spend the last 4 years we'd have together. And we had a lot of family in Florida. So that's when she decided it would make sense to move to Florida, where I would do high school and then continued. I did continue to college.
So you got to stay with your mom.
I did.
How was that 4 years? How did it work out?
Those were teenage years, right? So those were bound to be a little rough. I think my dad was like,
maybe I should have gone to boarding school, Mom. Right? Maybe you should have gone to the Middle East with Dad. You know, it might have been a good thing.
I think she definitely thought that many times, though she never said it. But it was amazing to have had that time, because it's true, after high school, when you leave to college, you don't really return home. Although I'm blessed that about 6 years ago, they moved down the street from me. So
then you went to the University of Florida, which is a great school, and you got your Bachelor of Science in Finance. Why finance? What intrigued you about going into that? What was the impetus for that?
Again, this, you have to remember, when I was in high school, was before the time of Google. So my whole world of understanding was either, because I'm Indian, it was doctors or engineers.
Yes.
And I didn't really want to be that. So I saw the movie Pretty Woman, and I thought, yes, that's what I want to do. Obviously not Julia Roberts, but Richard Gere. Yeah. I thought, wow, he's wealthy. He can do the right thing by this guy with his company. And so I just started to try to figure out, like, what does someone do to become like that? And it was explained to me as private equity. And so I started to pursue that path. And that's why I majored in finance.
Awesome. And you went from finance, a graduate in finance. Did you go straight into grad school, or did you go work for a while?
No, I went from there into mergers and acquisitions, actually in defense and aerospace, because it was right post 9/11. So it was a very active group. And I would say stereotyping kind of worked in my favor, because it was also a very competitive group. So when I got in, because they only took three out of like the 60 analyst class, and I was probably one of the very few females in the class at all, they said, oh, well, sure, it's your strong engineering background. And I was like, actually, I'm a finance major, but cool.
That's interesting. I actually do a lot of work with entrepreneurs in the government sector up here in Washington, D.C., obviously. And I've gotten to work with a lot of people of Indian heritage who are, you know, they started out as 8A owners of, you know, minority owned businesses, and have grown into these massive, fantastically built, exciting technology firms that are doing great work for our U.S. government today. So it's pretty cool. And I think that's a great way to learn about business. How did you fare in the M&A world? How long did you last in that?
It's very direct path. It's a 2-year program as an analyst. I lived there. So I worked 7 days a week. I had my pajamas, my toothbrush. The thing in my favor was I had the entire bathroom to myself, because there weren't too many females in the bank. But it was rough. But you do learn an incredible amount about business. I think the training is invaluable, as brutal as it could definitely be at times. But I learned all about financial modeling and projecting and cap structures and all these things that I think would have taken years to maybe naturally learn outside of this particular industry. So it was honestly a really, really great training program.
And you went and got your MBA at Berkeley. Tell us about that.
I did. So actually after that, so I did that in Charlotte. Then I went to Boston and I worked in growth technology. And then I went over to San Francisco. So it's like east to west coast for me. But I went to Berkeley because I always sort of had this calling for social entrepreneurship. I just didn't know how that was going to happen. So I studied a lot of, you know, microloans and different processes that way. Although my background sort of pulled me back into the general private equity world, but that's sort of what led me to Berkeley. I just love this passion for people wanting to change the world.
I think Berkeley is a great campus. It's a great school.
And it's beautiful.
Obviously, you know, you got a lot of benefit out of that program. What did you do after your MBA program?
So then I actually got back into private equity with a turnaround firm, Sun Capital Partners in Florida. So that's how I ended up in Florida. And my husband also was going to school in San Francisco and then got an offer to start his practice down here. So it just seemed, you know, to come full circle. So that's what we did right after.
So, and in between, you had worked with TA Associates. I'm familiar with them. They're a growth equity fund.
Yes. Yeah. So that was before my master's. I was in Boston.
Right.
Yep.
Then, you know, for a while you were doing turnaround stuff and back ops, I saw was a company that that you had worked with. But you were also a professor at an adjunct professor at Lynn University. I'm an adjunct professor up here at George Mason University. And how was that experience for 4 years and 6 months?
I would say it was amazing in some ways because I love being in the university setting. I think it's great to be around people who are really energetic and seeing the world in different ways. I taught entrepreneurship, consumer psychology, and economics, and they were just all topics that I loved. As you might know, adjunct professor, I couldn't even pay for the nanny to take care of my kids while I was there on that. So
I can identify with that.
It was never going to be a full long-term thing, but it was a great way to give back. It was a great way to connect with this community that was now, you know, going to be my forever home. So in that way, I thought it was a really great experience. And I did enjoy teaching.
And Florida is your forever home now?
Yes.
And so, you know, you went from being an investment banker or an M&A expert. You got some experience in actually working in-house with companies. Tell us about your experience at Have Big Plans LLC. That was a 6-year stint.
Yeah. So then I just really became more of a consultant because it was a, you know, I would say a rocky ride in terms of hours at that point in my life and where I was with children. So I started to work with the portfolio companies that I had had. And so that was sort of the Have Big Plans was around that.
So you
growth
were working
consulting.
With entrepreneurs daily.
Correct.
On different stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. And then what you learn is when you work for yourself, you end up just working as hard anyway. So.
Oh yeah. You know, it's a misconception. When you go out on your own, you think, oh, I'll be free to do what I want to do. And no, you'll be free to do what your clients want you to do.
Correct.
And then, you know, if you have time to do other things, that's great. But usually if you want to be successful, you're going to be working as hard as you were, maybe not as hard as you were when you first got out of school.
Right.
Because that's 7 days a week, 24/7 type atmosphere it's not embedded in the young people today. I can tell you that.
You know, and I'm glad it's not sustainable. You could do it for 2 years right out of college. I think that's probably the only time you could do that kind of that level of hustle. But I agree. There's definitely a work ethic that you build very, very quickly.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I'm in my 60s today, but I came up in an environment very similar to what you came up in terms of how you work, and you work as hard as you work is as good as you're going to get is the philosophy. So, you know, you have to work hard in order to achieve. Today I see a lot of younger people in their 20s and maybe even early 30s with a different approach, that there's a balance to life that needs to be achieved. And that sort of bridges me into my next series of questions about how you ended up migrating into what you're doing today. You know, I read your bio on the web, and it said you became more immersed in your Indian heritage and you discovered the power of human design. And you're the first person I've come in contact with outside of somebody who introduced that concept to me about 2 weeks ago, about telling me what human design is. Can you describe what that is? What is it? Where does it come from? And why? What attracted you to this whole concept of human design?
What attracted me to it was it resonated. So the first time I took it, it sort of tells you your energy type. And I've always believed we're all energy, right? So there's all these different vibrations. Nature has a vibration. We have vibration. Our devices, everything has these different vibrations. And as I was struggling with my own health journey of everyone saying you're completely fine, but me not feeling fine, I started to really look back and say, okay, what can I do? What are the things I've seen my family do or other people do that can maybe help change with whatever's happening that's not medically diagnosable? And okay, so that's sort of what led me into it. And then as I learned about it, during that journey, I was doing everything that I saw other people doing, right? So they were like, I run and that really makes me feel better. And I'm like, God, running is killing me. Or, there was just all these things that I'm like, why is it not working for me, right? Why is it working for them, but it's not working for me? And one of the things you realize is you have all this programming from all the information that we consume. And it's even worse now in this age of social media, where we're constantly consuming so much different information that we kind of forget our own intuition, which, you know, I always think it's really funny. Like, we need a device to tell us if we slept. Like, we can't wake up in the morning and say, like, did we get a good night of sleep or not? So we're so out of touch with our own intuition about how we feel after we eat something, or did we get a good night of sleep? And to me, human design really helps you come back into your own. So it was this connection to your inner nature, which Hinduism and a lot of the Vedas, that's what it's all about. It's about your connection and your journey to your inner self. And so that's where that sort of resonated and came together for me. Human design as a system actually takes into account a lot of different systems. So it does have the chakra system, which comes from India, but it also has I Ching, it has astrology, it has Kabbalah. So there's a lot of different knowledge systems that kind of come together, which is insane.
How do they do? I mean, I'm familiar with Kabbalah. I know what that is. I don't know about I Ching. I'm a little familiar with chakra. I know a little bit about astrology. How do you combine all that stuff together into a single system? Is it mathematical? I mean,
So astrology has some mathematical components, so it does. Yeah. And I think that the magic of how they did it was just to take a little bit from each. So it's not each system completely together, but it's each of them taking a little bit of each of them to help explain and better understand who you are, your purpose, where there could be programming, how you even orient yourself in an environment, right? So all of this is energetic ways. To me, the easiest way to think about it is it's all ways to help you raise your vibration. And depending on what you believe, raising your vibration could mean you manifest faster. It could mean that you are more at peace or you're just happier. Like, to me, it's all of those little hints at how you can become that more joyous person.
Are you a manifester?
No, I'm a generator.
So what is a generator, just out of curiosity?
So a generator is someone who has to constantly be doing. So it makes sense, the career path that I took and so forth, because I don't think there's many different energy types that could have been even a little bit happy with that, because for generators, you need to expend a lot of energy. So you have to go to bed exhausted. It's a normal sort of thing for you.
Okay.
So
then there are what, four or five types?
Yeah. So, depending, there's four main types. There's a fifth one that's like a manifesting generator, which is a combination of two of the types that really acts, I would say, a lot like a generator. But yeah, so once you figure out your energy type, you could start to see, like, how do I need to take care of myself? And how does that look different than somebody else?
I see. So, and the way I read it, it's a system that is defined at birth.
Yes.
At exactly the time you were born, which is difficult for a lot of people to ascertain, particularly if you're older and there's no records of, birth certificates and things like that that have that data on it. But I find it fascinating, and it's illuminating, and it's scarily accurate. But, you know, that's another discussion for another time. So you figured out your vibration, you figured out your human design, and it helped you migrate into the wellness industry. Tell us about that. Tell us about Kesa High and what it is that the company does and what you're trying to achieve.
Part of what caused me to go on my health journey was burnout, which makes sense given the hours I was working and the schedule I was keeping, and also just the eating habits of basically just living on coffee. So surprise, surprise, not good for you.
Celsius.
Yeah, right, exactly. And again, I think I had tuned so far away from my intuition of not listening, because what happens is your body's tired and you say, I don't care, I'm going to stay up, you know, and I'm going to give you these other things, caffeine or whatever. So you start to get very far away from your intuition. And so this brought me a little bit closer. And to me, it was like, wow, how could I have made this more accessible to people? Because I think the idea of meditation still is really uncomfortable for people, and spirituality is confusing. But all of it can be so incredibly impactful to one's life that I wanted to make it fun, easy, and that's sort of what became the ethos of the brand. Okay. For me, the oils worked really well because I had a leaky gut as a result of my amazing lifestyle previously. And all the vitamins and nutrients I wasn't able to absorb because a leaky gut is kind of like a bucket with holes in it. And so every time you're pouring anything in it, it's kind of like most of it's leaking out.
How do you know you have a leaky gut?
So you're probably going to have your digestion will be off, right? After you eat, a lot of times you don't feel great. And then a lot of times it's just malabsorption. So if you notice that you're low in D or low in a lot of different vitamin levels, you probably have a leaky gut.
And so you discovered you had this, and then you started investigating all the various aspects, nutrition, you know, oils, wellness products, wellness methodologies, meditation, all these things. On your website, you describe yourself as being certified in all these different areas. How long did it take you to get certified in this myriad areas?
I spent 10 years. So one of the clients I had been working with was an apothecary who I'd gotten introduced to because of the health issues I was having. So I didn't realize that oils could bypass your gut and go right into your bloodstream. That was something that I learned once I met her. Once I met her and tried the products, I was like, wow, we got to bring this to the world. So I helped her grow her company, sell it to investors. And during that sort of, I would say, 10-year-ish path is when I took time slowly to get certified in each of the different areas. And again, it wasn't really for any other reason than for my own knowledge. I just became so thirsty to understand how you could feel so vibrant and amazing and why people didn't know about it. Like, why is this a secret that you could do it? And the more I learned, the more I realized it was intuitively true. Intuitively, we should eat fresh fruits and vegetables. That seems like, duh. But yet we're not doing it. You know, intuitively, we shouldn't put chemicals on our skin, but we're doing it. So that's where, again,
what should you put on your skin?
Oil, natural plant oils. Just like you should eat natural fruits and vegetables on your skin, should go natural oils. So, and again, it's one of those things when you sit and think about it intuitively, you're like, yes, fragrance probably is not good for me. I can smell the chemicals that I'm inhaling, right? But until you remove it, just like sugar or anything else, you don't really feel the negative effect. And so I started to use it to get back into really intuitively feeling into what was right and what was wrong and how I wanted to really do business. And so that with that came the impact, so I could make it more of a social entrepreneurship thing, trying to source sustainably. All of that kind of started to feel right. And that's where I also felt like the human design helped, because it said, like, there's different gates that they have. That's like it's a more complicated layering. So you kind of start with your energy types, then you have your open and closed centers, and then you have these different gates. So one of mine was voice for the voiceless, and in sort of the way it was interpreted to me was, and community, was you're never going to be fully satisfied unless you're also helping. And so then that social entrepreneurship, that feeling of wanting to go to Berkeley, which is a great school, but not a traditional one for people in the private equity world,
right?
It sort of made sense. And so as I leaned into it more, and sometimes I think people can use human design as like the excuse, like, okay, yeah, I'm right. Like, not even the excuse, but the...
It's a
confirmation. Confirmation.
It helps you verify your
exactly.
feelings.
Right. Exactly. And
it actually helps direct you in the direction you should be moving based on your energy type and based on who you are.
Exactly.
How long has human design been around, by the way? Do you know?
I mean, it's been around for a long time. I couldn't tell you for sure how long.
But to me, I'm like you. When I have a thirst for learning and it's constant, I just immerse myself in it and I become certified, or I'll learn about it. So to the point where I know more about it than, not than anybody else, but more about it than I need to, because it's something that I want to learn about.
Correct.
So today you've got Kesahai, which is a website. It's a company. What else is it? It's a platform for launching wellness among human beings, correct?
It's a platform for a mind body wellness. I would say for the alchemy of it, the magic of it. So along with obviously having the oil products that helped me myself, and then also for the skin, we also do this impact work. We try to introduce brands that have the same ethos, so that are sustainable or support minority women or any really group that I think needs support. Because I think one of the things that people don't realize is policy is made by purchasing power. So if you purchase that in ways that are aligned with your values, you're going to shape policy. So if we only buy from companies that produce sustainably or give back, then that's how all companies will be. So that's one of the other things that I do. So again, I feel like it's become for me this platform for this mind, body, soul work.
What is your process for vetting potential vendors that go on the site? How do you determine that they're aligning with your values and the purpose of what you're trying to achieve on Kesahai?
Sure. So none of them actually go on the site. All the products on Kesahai are our own products. However, we have a newsletter that we have. It's called the Weekly Ananda, which is like your weekly happiness, where we have a mantra and we usually promote an artist and have some journaling prompts and, something about what's going on in the sky astrology wise, but we'll also there promote someone who we believe is doing good work. And we usually vet them just by their process, right? So do they fit a need in terms of, are we trying to support this particular entrepreneur? And then always, are they doing it in a sustainable way that's good for the environment? It has to be good for the people and the environment.
So the products on your site are products that you either source from other manufacturers and then you brand them on your site? Is that how you do it?
So we make all our own products. So all our products are made at at a manufacturing facility in Florida. And all the formulations have been ones that have been carried from that botanist over. And then, we have amazing people. Even though I'm certified, I'm not the one who's doing all these amazing formulations.
You're also making all the stuff on the
planet. Yeah. So we have experts that help do that. But it's all our own. I'm very particular about the types of oils we use. And a lot of that I've realized, again, the more you know, the more scary it becomes. But there's not a lot of regulation around natural products. And so, you can have lavender, which has over 200 different components, only have two components and call themselves lavender. And that's why you see these different prices, right? So essential oils can cost $2 or $200, but a lot of it is quality, how many times it's been pressed. And so that really becomes the difference. And so if you don't control that process, I think it becomes very hard to control the quality.
Do you have a team that works for you? How big is your team at Kesahai?
Yes, I do. We have 7 people.
And what are your goals? Where do you see yourself going in the next 5 to 10 years as a company?
So my goal is to make this sort of spiritual soul care every day. So really to be in shelves everywhere. So we've recently launched in Bloomingdale's, hopefully trying to take some more other larger retailers like that. That's truly the goal. From a team size, I like to stay small. So we outsource a lot of things and that's my style. I like that. Like our manufacturer, we don't own that manufacturer, right? So they produce our products. Same thing with marketing. We have a team that we hire that does that. So I actually find that to be a lot more peaceful than managing a lot of people. So I think from that standpoint, I don't really want to expand, but
you don't want to use your energy for that purpose.
Correct.
I'm with you 1,010%.
Yes.
As an owner of a couple of businesses. I like to outsource as much as I possibly can. The only issue that I find in outsourcing is control and quality control. And how have you found it as a person that does a lot of your work with outsourced?
It's honestly, you have to just become amazing at being a really great HR manager, right? So you have to take that person who's outsourced and just, you have to keep, first of all, you have to keep trying. You know, it definitely took a while to find the right partners, and you can't get discouraged in that process, because that's true of employees as well. But once they're on your team, I really treat them as a part of the team. So, you know, they're getting the updates, whether they want them or not, and really getting on it. But I have found that it's not any harder to manage the quality control internally or externally when you have the right, when you have the right people.
Do people who are interested in what you're doing, do they subscribe to the website? Is there a subscription service that you offer?
Yeah. So for the weekly newsletter, you can subscribe there. And then all of the, you know, we have the soul quiz for the human design. We have the wellness quiz if you want to see what oils. And we have a skin quiz that tells you the botanicals that are best for your particular skin.
That is wonderful. And if people want to know more about Kay Sahai and become a subscriber and a user of your products, how do they do that?
The website's the best place. It's ksahai.com. And on social, we're at Love Kay Sahai.
At Love Kay Sahai. Oh, Sahai. Awesome. Well, you know, I'm very intrigued by what you're doing. I'm probably going to, as soon as we get off, I'm very serious, going to be a subscriber to your site, because I'm interested in learning more about this. Even at my advanced age, I'm always learning new things about how to take care of my ancient body and ancient mind. But I think it's inspiring to watch you get into an area that you're passionate about, and but using all of the education that you've acquired through your finance background, your MBA, working with entrepreneurs, working in the retail industry, and then applying it to achieve your goals and objectives. It's a beautiful thing to watch. So I'm very, very happy to have met you.
Thank you. Likewise.
And thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been so great.
And thanks for watching and tuning in to Blueprint for Wealth. And tune in next time for another amazingly inspiring entrepreneur. Have a great week. Today, we're going to have a special topic, and then we're going to have a special guest. And our first special topic today is continuing the discussion of choice of entity when you're forming a business. And that choice of entity really depends on what you're going to be doing and how you're going to be doing it. Today, we're going to talk about partnerships and how they work. What is a partnership, and what kinds of partnerships are there under the various state laws? Well, the most basic example of a partnership is a general partnership. I walk up to you on the street. I know you. I shake your hand and I say, partner, let's be partners. Let's go invest in that real estate venture down the street. Or let's go ahead and open up a hot dog stand here on the side of the street. And we shake hands and we agree to be partners, and then we start operating as a partnership. That's how simple it is to create a general partnership. But watch out for general partnerships. They're really a thing of the past. We don't use them very much today, and I'll tell you why in a second. Then there's the limited partnership, or LP. In a limited partnership, by state law, you almost always have to have one general partner, referred to as a GP, and one or more limited partners. So in Texas, for example, when we set up entities, we use limited partnerships pretty frequently. We'll have a general partner, and we may have one, we may have 50 limited partners in the limited partnership that we're setting up. There's also something called a limited liability partnership, which became extremely popular in the wake of the Enron debacle that put away one of the greatest accounting firms ever to be on earth, and that was Arthur Andersen and Company. I started my career at Arthur Andersen in 1980, and I was there for a while, and I still maintain contact with some of my former colleagues at Arthur Andersen, but it was put out of business because it was essentially a general partnership among all of its partners around the United States and around the world, and several of the partners and the Houston office were involved in the Enron crisis that led to the massive liability and massive failure of Enron, which ultimately led to the demise of the great Arthur Andersen accounting firm. So these LLPs are limited liability partnerships, and they're usually used by professionals, accountants, lawyers, sometimes doctors, although in some states it's not permitted. And the LLP basically says that my liability as a partner, professional in that firm, is limited to my own negligence and my own torts, the bad acts that I've committed. But the partnership debts, I may have a pro rata responsibility for based on my ownership of the partnership. But I'm not liable for my partner's malpractice or bad things that they may have done. Then we've got the limited liability, limited partnership, which is also a relatively new creature of statute, and it's not found in all of the states, but it operates somewhat like a limited partnership. However, the key distinction is that you can limit the liability for a general partner in an LLLP if an election is filed and other requirements are met. So let's talk about general partnerships. I mentioned you need to be careful and you need to be cautious if you're forming a general partnership. And a lot of families enter into general partnership arrangements not really understanding what they're getting into. A partner in a general partnership is personally liable for all business debts incurred by the partnership, even if they didn't agree to be liable for it. It basically refers to the concept of joint and several liability, which means that even though you were, say, a 50% partner with your brother or your cousin in a partnership, and your brother or your cousin go out and incur a debt, you're liable for the whole debt if it's in the name of the partnership. Any individual partner in a general partnership generally can bind the entity to a contract or a transaction. So it's risky to get involved in a general partnership. How are partnerships taxed? Well, they're basically pass-through entities, meaning that revenue minus expenses and certain other items, such as credits and charitable deductions, are passed through to the partners on a Schedule K-1 that's attached to the partnership return, which is referred to as Form 1065. So usually with very few exceptions, some state law exceptions, partnerships do not pay tax on their income. And as I mentioned, income, deductions, credits, and losses pass through to the owners. But then the question is, can the owners use all of those losses that are passed through to them? There are three basic limitations that we always point to. One is limited to your basis in the partnership, which equals the amounts that you contributed to the partnership, plus whatever debts are allocated to you under the debt allocation rules in the partnership provisions of the tax code. There's also a risk known as at risk. Are you really personally liable for this debt that the partnership incurred? And then there are some exceptions to that. If you're not able to satisfy these two limitations, you can't claim the loss, and the loss is suspended and carried forward. In 1986, the Tax Reform Act of 1986 introduced the passive loss rules under Code Section 469 of the Internal Revenue Code, and that further limits your ability to claim losses currently and offset them against other income, like your compensation income that you generate. These passive loss rules are very complex and really would involve an entire separate presentation that might be twice as long as this presentation is today. Now let's talk about liability in partnerships. Again, in a general partnership and in a limited partnership, the general partner is personally liable for the debts of the partnership. So in many cases, in virtually all cases that I can think of, you want to have a limited liability entity serving as the general partner or general partners of a general partnership or limited partnership. In that event, you might use a corporation or a limited liability company, or in some cases, you might use what we refer to as an irrevocable trust that could serve as the general partner and limit the liability of the entity to basically the corporate general partner or LLC and not expose your personal assets. Let me give you an example. Your partner, Bill, goes out, signs up with the local bank, takes out a high interest rate loan in the name of the partnership, proves that he's a general partner, and the bank lends him the money without your knowledge or your consent. If the partnership is a general partnership, you're fully liable for the loan. Again, can't emphasize enough, partnerships, sole proprietorships, any business should get commercial insurance, business insurance, errors and omissions insurance, general liability insurance, workers' compensation insurance if you've got employees, umbrella insurance if it's available, and other types of insurance, including cybersecurity risk insurance, which is really important today. And then, of course, you want to enter into a very clearly written partnership agreement. But if I'm in your shoes, I would use an LLLP, a limited liability company, or a corporation if I were operating the business. Partnership agreements are really important to flesh out the liability, governance, and other aspects of running the business. It allows you to allocate profits and losses and cash flow. It allows you to restrict the transfer of the interests. And it deals with such situations as retirement or death or disability or the withdrawal of a partnership. Without an agreement, you're subject to the statute in the state in which you operate. For general partnerships, those statutes are commonly known as the Uniform Partnership Act or the Revised Partnership Act. For limited partnerships, it's known as the ULPA or the Uniform Limited Partnership Act or Revised Uniform Limited Partnership Act. In California, for example, these statutes would restrict you from adding a new member or new partner to the partnership without unanimous consent of all of the partners. You may not want to restrict the entity that much. What is it that a partnership cannot do? Well, a partnership cannot avoid personal liability for business debts, even though it says that you are limited to the liability that you might have in the partnership if it's a general partnership. And general partners can't limit their liability, but they can certainly seek contribution from other general partners or other partners that they're working with. A partnership agreement also is not allowed to restrict a partner's rights to inspect the books and records of the business. And you cannot limit the rights of third parties in relationship to the partnership. For example, in the example I used before where Bill wanted to enter into this borrowing arrangement with a third party on behalf of the partnership, the third party has knows that Bill has authority, apparent authority to act on behalf of the partnership. So the partnership agreement can't restrict that third party's right to enter into that agreement with Bill because the third party doesn't know about it. So unless the third party is actually bound to this agreement, they're not bound by your partnership agreement that limits your liability to the partnership and therefore the creditors of the partnership. You also, in a fiduciary situation, you cannot eliminate or weaken the fiduciary duties that are owed by each partner to the other. The duties of loyalty, the duties of care, the duties of prudence, the duties to administer the partnership properly. If you've got questions on how to set up a partnership of whatever type, let us know. Give us a call at our phone number at 571-203-ZELL or look us up on the web and send us an email at zelllaw.com. I'm Wayne Zell. You've been watching Blueprint for Wealth, a video cast that hopefully is helping you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom.